Okay, well, now, here to sum it all up, and I will hope you all stick around, is Matt Cartmill, who hopefully is going to resolve all unresolved questions. And so I had the privilege of overlapping with Matt while I did my doctorate at Duke University while he was there, and now I'm happy to find myself in the same university with him again. And so Matt is one of the leading experts on the evolution of early primates and on the human-animal boundary. He's a world-class scholar and a polymath, and I can think of no one better to sum up everything that we've done here today than this gentleman right here. So please welcome Matt. Thank you.
Well, I think rather than sum everything up, I'll just throw the floor open for discussion. Is that no? Then. So I'm supposed to give a synthetic commentary. Synthetic is another word meaning not real, and it's appropriate in this case because I wrote all of these comments before I heard any of the talks today. And since I've heard the talks, I've seen that a number of the things I was going to say have already been said, so we can skip over those. And a number of the other things I was going to say are not true, and we can skip over those. So I'm hoping we can keep things fairly short here today. I was going to start out, and I'm also going to skip over some things that I don't think anybody wants to hear about at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. I was going to start out by talking about what convergence means and why it has a precise meaning and not a vague meaning. And the distinction between convergence and other kinds of things, it depends partly, I think, on recognizing the difference between convergence and parallelism, but I'm not going to go into that. Let's just say that when we look at any kind of organism, we find that there are an endless number of similarities between any pair of organisms and an endless number of differences. And if you look at these four organisms, you can immediately, on the basis of overall general similarity, sort them out into two groups, the two on the left and the two on the right. And there are dozens of features that unite those two groups together. Okay, but when we look at all of the features that are visible in this slide, there's only one feature, only one similarity between two animals here that represents a parallelism. That represents a convergence. So I'll ask you to see if you can figure out in advance which one it is. We find, for example, that all the animals on the left have 5 digits and those on the right have 2 digits. And there are a whole bunch of other things like that that unite the two groups and produce this overall impression of general similarity between humans and apes on the one hand and sheep and goats on the other. 3-color vision versus red-green colorblind, clavicle, no clavicle, 5 versus 2 digits, large, small brain, simple, complex stomach, no tail, tail, and so on and so forth. Okay? None of these represents convergence. Okay? They contribute to the overall patterns of similarity, but they're all either ancestral retentions, or they're what we call synapomorphies, that is, characters of shared derivation. There are other patterns of similarity here. For example, we see that those 3 animals have fur and the one in the upper left doesn't. And that's because fur is a primitive feature. It's inherited from the last common ancestor of all 4 of these animals. Only characters of shared derivation, what we call synapomorphies, are capable of carrying phylogenetic information, and fortunately there are a lot of those, things that were not present in the common ancestor of all 4, but that evolved later on in the shared ancestors of the 2 pairs. Big brains, poor olfaction, no tail, and so on the left, cud chewing, no canine teeth, toe loss, and so on the right. Okay. The last common ancestor had none of these features, and so they are changes from the ancestral condition that carry phylogenetic information. Fur, on the other hand, is a retained primitive feature. Okay, the fact that chimpanzees have retained it and humans haven't tells us nothing about the relationship between chimpanzees, sheep, and goats. Okay, the common ancestor of all of these animals was furred, speechless, quadrupedal, and ate raw food, and the fact that people don't do that doesn't represent a convergence between the other 3. Okay. That's just a slide of something, last common ancestor looked something like that, a Mesozoic mammal. Okay, so here's the only convergence. The males had beards. in goats and human beings. That's it. Okay? So determining whether a particular resemblance between two organisms represents a convergence or not, then, requires that we know how they fit into a larger phylogenetic picture, a tree diagram of evolutionary relationships, and what the character in question looked like in their last common ancestor, namely, no beards in Mesozoic mammals. Okay. For example, this has a lot of important implications for thinking about the convergence of minds. For example, there are no mental characteristics that chimpanzees share with humans that can be identified as convergences, because we can't know whether they were present in our last common ancestor or not. Okay, and this has a bearing on the way we need to think about these issues. Let's consider an issue that was raised in some of the earlier talks, the Gallup mirror test, okay, the ability to respond or to, at least learn to respond to your reflection as a self-image rather than as a stranger of your own species. Some people think this is an index of self-awareness, but I tend to agree with Cohen and Laurie, who said that what it means is actually very unclear. Okay, but whatever it implies about mentation, I started to say whatever it reflects, the mirror test is one that few mammals and few birds and no reptiles can pass. Among our primate relatives, some chimpanzees and orangutans and a few gibbons and old world monkeys can pass it. Okay, but gorillas cannot. This is a wild gorilla doing a threat display at its own reflection in a mirror. There's a video of this on YouTube. You can watch the gorilla banging itself against the mirror incessantly as though it were a cardinal seeing the reflection of that evil other male cardinal in the window pane outside your bedroom. So the most parsimonious phylogenetic interpretation of these results is not that chimpanzees and gorillas display convergent minds that have evolved human-like properties, but that gorillas have lost something. Okay, that other living hominoids, including us, have retained from our shared last common ancestor. So among hominoids, self-awareness, or whatever it is that this mirror test measures, appears to be a primitive trait. It's advanced or derived only when we compare it with the next phylogenetic outgroup. So the immediately interesting question is whether and why gorillas have lost this cognitive capacity, and what other species may have lost it, and for what adaptive reasons, why this change. And knowing the answer to this question might shed more light on the nature of self-awareness than the Gallup test itself does. There's a serious temptation, I think, in talking about the evolution of mind, and I'd like to say that it is a temptation that I have been enormously gratified to see universally resisted at this symposium. But there's a serious temptation to fall into a pre-Darwinian way of thinking about mental capacities as arrayed along a linear sequence, a manifestation of the old scala naturae, the chain of being, with all change being along a human-like vectors produced by the gradual accretion of more and more advanced or human-like mental abilities. And I think this way of thinking is embedded in some of the fundamental axioms of comparative psychology. For example, in Morgan's canon here, which was, I think, implicitly critiqued and rejected by Irina Mikhailovich in her very interesting presentation this afternoon. Morgan's canon is, as I said, it's kind of an axiom of comparative psychology, but to me it has never been clear why it's supposed to be economical or parsimonious. Okay, on the face of it, it seems uneconomical to explain an animal's behavior in one way and a similar human behavior in a different way. And some philosophers have argued, in fact, that if we are going to invoke mental phenomena in accounting for our own actions, we should explain other animals in human-like terms whenever we possibly can, and only deviate from human-like explanations when we're forced to. Because deviating from human-like explanations is contrary to Occam's razor. It requires the unnecessary multiplication of entities, since we already know that humans have minds and all these other mental properties. And oddly enough, Morgan himself agreed that it would be more parsimonious to do just that, to explain everything in anthropomorphic terms. So he justified his canon not with respect to the principle of parsimony, but with regard to the fact of evolution, which he saw in characteristically 19th century terms as the grand saga of life's ascent up from the primordial ooze to the apex of organized being and human creation. And the key to understanding Morgan's canon, and this is a phrase that has, I think, surfaced occasionally here today, is that phrase, lower in the scale of psychological evolution. Okay, for Morgan, lower didn't mean neurologically simpler. Could be done with fewer neurons in the network. Rather, it meant historically prior, with specific reference to the story of human evolution. So higher here turns out to mean distinctively human, and lower to mean shared with other species to a greater or lesser extent. So the true underlying implication of Morgan's canon and all similar assumptions about explaining and accounting for and describing mental similarities among organisms is that we are forbidden to interpret an animal's action as the outcome of human-like mental events if we can possibly find any other way of explaining them. And I think reformulating it in this way shows me more clearly what's wrong with Morgan's canon, why it's problematic. The problem comes into sharp focus if we transfer our attention momentarily, if you will, from the brain to, let's say, the kidney. Okay, so a urological version of Morgan's canon would forbid us to explain an animal's urine as the outcome of human-like kidney events, if we can find any other way of explaining it. But it's obvious that the urological version is ridiculous. No physiologist would insist that we adopt such a rule to avoid the insidious temptations of anthroporenalism. Okay? Morgan's canon makes sense only by virtue of an underlying, unstated, and unexamined assumption that mental evolution is scalar and unidirectional and culminates in the human condition. Now, when we stop thinking about the scala natura and start thinking about convergent minds in generally phylogenetic terms based on tree diagrams rather than a scale from lower to higher, we can see that convergence isn't a single simple variable. Okay, different environmental situations select for different changes in brain size, behavioral flexibility, cognitive complexity. And this too can entail mental convergence of kinds that are not like what we like to think of as being in a human-like direction. And just as in the case of gorillas in the mirror test, I think we can learn just as much, or perhaps more, from studying losses as from studying the sort of accumulating resemblances to humans that we tend to concentrate on in this connection. Okay, for example, consider the extinct Balearic Island goat, Myotragus. Myotragus lived during the Pleistocene on these islands off the Mediterranean coast of Spain, shown here in purple. Okay, and this animal has very peculiar anatomy for a goat. It had short, stubby legs. Its eyes, unlike any other artiodactyl I know of, have been rotated around the front like a monkey's. Okay? And it has, for its body size, strikingly and peculiarly small brain. It has some other very peculiar features about its skeleton. The skeleton has growth rings in it like a tree. This is a feature of reptile bone. It is not a feature of mammalian bone. The conclusion is this animal had stopped being warm-blooded. It was not homeothermic anymore. Okay, so why did this happen? Well, one contention is, and it seems reasonable to me, you know, these islands are small in area, they have very limited resources, and there were no predators on them. All right? So it made sense to crunch down everything that required major metabolic expense, including being warm-blooded, to get short-legged, since you no longer needed the panoramic view of the horizon to defend against predators, the eyes could drift around towards the front, making them perhaps more useful in foraging. And similar sort of evolutionary changes are seen among other island mammals. For example, this Miocene ape Oreopithecus, which lived in what is now Tuscany, but was at that time an isolated island in the middle of the Mediterranean, the same sort as the Balearics. This is, in a lot of respects, the most advanced ape known during the Miocene. It has a post-cranium that looks very much like that of a modern ape, except it's got a peculiarly small brain, as you can see by comparing the reconstructed skull with that of a modern chimpanzee. Here's another rather bothersome example of a little island form, a dwarf human, dating back to about 17,000 years ago, isolated on a small Indonesian island, the island of Flores. This thing is a member of our own genus, but it's got a brain that's smaller than that of an adult chimpanzee. Again, a suggestion of reduction in brain and presumably concomitant reduction in cognitive and behavioral capacities as a specific convergent adaptation to living on islands. And as was noted in the discussion following the Arenas talk, there was a similar reduction in brain size, which is probably also related to reduction in predator pressures, is characteristic of almost all domesticated animals, including those that have been brought into captivity very recently. When I was a kid, nobody owned a gerbil. First gerbil I ever saw, I saw in a pet store when I was in graduate school. It cost $40. I bought one. Okay? They were strange, rare animals. Okay, in the amount of time between then and the time this paper was published in, 2006, gerbil brains go like this. From the wild condition, brain body rate plot, to the laboratory gerbil. Okay? And as you also heard in the discussion following the Arenas talk, this may not be entirely irrelevant to convergence with humans because our brains have also been shrinking. Here's a graph showing human brain size over the course of the last 1.8 million years. And you'll notice these are time sum averages, the red stars. Brain size gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger up until about 20,000 years ago, and then it goes and crashes. It doesn't crash. You know, we've still got very big brains, but not nearly as big brains by an amount of brain about the size of a tennis ball as people had 20,000 years ago. So are we getting stupider? Okay? But I'm not sure what that means. But we may be developing less behavioral and physiological plasticity and resilience because of the huge environmental buffers that 20,000 years of accumulated technology has provided for us. I was going at this point to talk about other aspects of inflexible human behavior, particularly gaits, but we'll skip that. So to talk about convergence at all, we have to refer not to a scale, but to a phylogenetic tree. Okay, there are 30-odd phyla of multicellular animals laid out here. Of these, three have evolved what the cognitive science and philosopher Michael Trustman referred to in 2013 as complex active bodies, which is a cluster of five related properties listed on the left-hand side of this slide. And today, these five properties can be found only in three lineages out of the approximately 34 described phyla of multicellular animals, namely arthropods, mollusks, and chordates. And as you will have noticed, these are precisely the three groups in which our speakers today have noted the evidence of such properties as behavioral flexibility and have led them to try to discern the presence of convergent minds. And it seems reasonable to assume that this cluster of properties is a necessary substrate for mental evolution of any sort. But the evidence for the presence of mental events of some sort is much clearer in the chordates than it is in the other two phyla. And that brings me to the second word in the title of our symposium today, namely minds. Mind. Deep philosophical pitfalls and morasses open at our feet as soon as that word enters our discourse. But I feel compelled to raise for our concluding discussion the question of whether behavior without mental events can count as evidence for convergence of minds. I tend to agree with the philosopher John Searle that the fundamental issue here is the presence or absence of consciousness. Now, there are eminent thinkers, including some of the people in this room, who would argue that this issue is a red herring, that consciousness is at best what Thomas Henry Huxley called a steam whistle on the locomotive, and at worst a ghost in the machine, and then we can dispense with it by talking about it. We can dispense with talking about it and studying the question of convergent minds. I personally disagree. Me, I believe in philosophical zombies. Okay, that is to say, in the possibility of complex, flexible, human-like behavior that is not accompanied by mental events. In fact, I would argue that human sleepwalkers are, in fact, philosophical zombies. But I think further that the facts of comparative anatomy and behavior suggest the presence of philosophical zombies elsewhere in the animal kingdom. This is a spider of a group that you've seen a couple of examples of following on one of Irena's slides. This is a jumping spider of the genus Portia. Okay, these animals feed on other spiders, on web-spinning spiders. Okay, they approach them by wide swinging, circuitous detours that break visual contact with the prey, so neither the prey nor the Porsche can see each other. They're careful to remain out of sight. They avoid approaching the prey directly. They get up towards the edge of the web, and then they wait for a little breeze that ruffles the web and masks the vibrations of their initial contact with the web. And once they've touched the web, they start plucking at it to produce vibrations that mimic the struggles of trapped insects. And if one pattern of vibrations doesn't work, they try another, and another, and another, and another. Dozens of patterns, sometimes mimicking the struggles of prey, sometimes mimicking the courtship web stroking of male spiders of the appropriate genus. They can keep this up for days. Eventually the prey comes out and approaches, and it approaches too close and they jump on it and kill it, using different combat tactics depending on the size and species of the prey. Now, all this is very sophisticated in plastic behavior. It incorporates what appear to be long-term intentionality, learning, and insight. Okay, an opossum could not possibly manage anything this complicated. It would take something, I think, like a very clever cat to carry off the sort of thing that these jumping spiders do. Now, Lars Chitka's presentation roused me from my dogmatic slumbers about brain size. And yet, I would still be very reluctant to talk about the mind of a jumping spider. This is a tiny animal with a brain containing a few hundred thousand neurons. Okay, not unlike some of the insects that Lars told you about. Now, we don't know what the material basis of consciousness is, but it seems clear that there is one. If you do nasty things to the brain, consciousness ceases to exist, like drinking too much alcohol or hitting yourself repeatedly on the head with a hammer, or simply going to sleep. Whatever the material basis of consciousness is, I suspect from the ease with which it can be eradicated from the operations of the human brain, that a mass of neurons about a quarter of the size of a pinhead is not sufficient to produce it. And if I'm correct in thinking that, then Porsche is a philosophical zombie cat. Okay, my personal suspicion is that while there is something that it is like to be a cat, there is nothing that it is like to be a jumping spider. Being a jumping spider is an experience like being a doorknob, or a computer, or a thermostat. That is to say, it is not a category of experience at all. And if so, I'm inclined to say that convergence in behavior between jumping spiders and mammals, or cats, does not constitute evidence for the convergence of minds. In this connection, I would like to hear an open discussion of the meaning of the word cognition, because I still don't understand it, and I'm pleased to see that some of our speakers didn't either. It's commonly used in a way that allows us to talk about cognition in computers and robots, e.g. the information processing definition that was discussed earlier. I'm not persuaded that cognition so defined has any bearing on the evolution of minds. To finish up with Porsche, I wanted to note that jumping spiders, uniquely among terrestrial arthropods, have evolved vertebrate-type, camera-like imaging eyes with retinas. And this should remind us that cognitive potentials and the complexity of behavior and the presence of and quality of mind and mental events depend not only on the behavioral output from the brain, but also on the complexity of the sensory input into it. Most other vertebrates with image-forming eyes belong to the mollusks, and of all the mollusks, as you know by now, the cephalopod mollusks exhibit the most vertebrate-like eyes and the largest brain-to-body weight ratios. The dots on this are cephalopods, octopus and squid. In between the reptile and fish scatter and the birds and mammals scatter, most of them. Notice, incidentally, that 1, 2, and 3 are animals in the genus octopus, which was talked about in Laurie's talk, and which, in fact, has a rather small brain compared to some of the pelagic squid and cuttlefish. At the other end of the scale of encephalization in cephalopods are the small brain Mesozoic survivor Nautilus, and a number of genera which are drifting jellyfish-like filter feeders like this thing, which rejoices in the name of Vampyrotoothus infernalis, meaning the vampire squid from hell. You have a question?
Vampyrotoothus, this guy, has the biggest vertical lobe.
Yes.
and we don't know why.
That's right.
We do know that the vertical lobe is where information is stored for memory functions.
Fair enough. I was looking at the overall sum of all the damn ganglia that constitute the so-called brain of cephalopods, which is rather small in Vampyrotuthis compared to mantle length. I don't have body weight data on Vampyrotuthis, so I couldn't put it on the plot.
Well, we don't know why they've got such a huge vertical lobe.
No, we don't. We don't. And I don't, anyway. I was hoping you did. Okay, well, mapped onto a phylogeny of the cephalopods, then, there's a spotty phylogeny of large brains and complex behavior. This thing just drifts around and trails sticky filaments like jellyfish. So this demonstrates... Huh? Go ahead.
I have to point out that where they are is in the deep ocean.
Oh, yes, it's almost anoxic.
We have no idea of their behavior. We have a few little...
Yes, we do. But they do, in fact, go around trailing long, sticky filaments and snapping up the planktonic snow that's coming down from above.
Possibly.
Okay.
All right. Or to put it another way, that's probably not all they do.
Yeah, it may not be all they do, but they can't do too much because the areas that they tend to inhabit tend to be rather anoxic.
Well, they probably can do much, but they will do it quite slowly.
Ah, okay. Well, maybe that's true. Anyway... There's a spotty distribution of large brains and complex behavior. That was the only. I didn't mean to put down Vampyrotuthis, which is a very interesting animal, even if it's the vampire from hell. So we're dealing with multiple cases of convergence among the cephalopods, not just one, in features that we are assuming here are markers of mental convergence with our own kind. But again, I'm not very confident that there's anything that it's like to be an octopus. Because, as Jennifer Madden noted, their central nervous systems are extremely diffuse and decentralized. Life history theory assures us that complex cognition and large brains and complicated behavior are grounded in slow life histories, okay, involving a prolonged early phase of brain growth, and an extended learning period prior to the onset of the reproductive part of the life cycle. Okay, this is in all the primatology and anthropology textbooks. Okay, as Jennifer has reminded us, the cephalopods show that this whole body of theory is not true. Okay, despite the huge literature of primatology and biological anthropology and general biology that swallows these assumptions without question, I'm not sure that I believe the claim that reef cephalopods have high intelligence combined with short lifespans because coral reefs are a complex and demanding environment, simply because some of the pelagic non-reef inhabiting squids have larger brain to body weight ratios, and because this account doesn't seem to apply to other cases of animals, highly edible small animals living in very complicated environments. I think of possums immediately in this connection. The behavioral flexibility and cognitive capacities of birds, which Thomas Bugnaar sketched in his paper on raven politics, are probably the most striking example of convergent minds that we've heard about today. And as he mentioned, phylogenetic studies demonstrate that the last common ancestor of birds and mammals was something like this, a primitive reptile back in the late Carboniferous, distinguishable from its salamander-like amphibian contemporaries only by technical details of the skeleton. Birds, which are phylogenetically small dinosaurs, have evolved over the past 150 million years into startling mental convergence with some of the most human-like mammals, including, in the cases of parrots and corvids, abilities to make tools and speak simplified, non-syntactic versions of human languages. In these capacities, some birds equal or excel our closest living relatives, the great apes. They do this using brains the size of walnuts. And this fact, I think, raises some fundamental questions about the relationship between brain size, behavior, and cognition. In her paper on carnivore brain evolution, Kay Holkamp studied 39 species in the order Carnivora and found that those with absolutely larger brains, not relatively, but absolutely larger brains, were more successful in solving puzzles. Okay, so some general background. On bivariate plots of log transformed body weights, x-axis, and brain weights, y-axis. Living mammals fall into a roughly linear scatter with a slope of less than 1.0. And that less than one slope means that bigger animals have absolutely larger brains than smaller animals, but relatively smaller brains than smaller animals do. And there's a large literature debating whether the theoretical slope of this line should be two-thirds, reflecting surface-to-body relationships, or three-quarters, reflecting differences in basal metabolic rate. Whichever we pick, the negative allometry itself indicates that for roughly equivalent cognitive and behavioral capacities, an increase in relative size is always matched by a decrease in absolute size, and conversely. And this makes sense in terms of Lori Holkamp's findings. I nevertheless feel moved to ask with Lars Chitka, why does an absolutely bigger animal need an absolutely bigger brain? A bigger car doesn't need a bigger computer chip. Does the number of inputs and outputs differ in an elephant and a mouse? And if so, why and how much? Okay, and there's another fact about this distribution that deserves mention, probably. And that is that no matter how we decide to fit a line to this scatter, the smallest and largest animals at the two ends fall below that line, suggesting that they have smaller brains than would be expected for their body size. While animals in the middle of the size distribution, such as Homo, that blue square, and the smaller cetaceans, the red circles, they tend to fall above it. In other words, the observed scatter is not straight, it's curved. In a brilliant and much overlooked paper written shortly before he came to BU, Terence Deacon, who's now at Berkeley, pointed out that there's absolutely no theoretical reason for assuming that this relationship ought to be linear, and that the true allometric relationship here might be curvilinear, again, for no known or discernible reason. He may be right. But I'd like to venture an alternative suggestion, namely that the curvature in this scatter is due not to facts about the allometry of neuroanatomy, but to facts about ecology. Because of the square cube law, very small warm-blooded animals at the left end of this scatter live close to the edge of metabolic collapse. They have too little heat generating inside for the amount of heat radiating outside. And because neural tissue is very metabolically expensive with a high rate of glucose turnover, they simply may not be able to afford to have brains of optimal size. At the other end of the size spectrum, very large mammals generally have very few predators, and they may be able to get away with brains that are smaller than you would expect for their size for the same reason that Hylamese and Homo floresiensis could get away with it. And, okay. One test of whether an animal's mind is strikingly convergent with our own, I think, might be... I'm going to skip that part. Okay. Huh?
I'm curious now.
No, never mind. I want to leave time for discussion. We're already past 5:30. So let's move on. Okay. The red X's here, I'll just say that the red X's here on this diagram represent animals with which human beings can enter into mutually gratifying social relationships. Okay. I know from personal experience that you can't do that with opossums or tree shrews, and therefore, I've tried. And therefore, primitive mammals did not have that kind of cognitive capacity or depth to them. Okay, but one of the groups in which this sort of relationship is possible is cetacea, which Lori Marino told us about. Lori also told us about brain evolution in cetacea and noted a zigzag pattern of cetacean evolution in EQ, encephalization quotient. What I would like to propose to you is that EQ, which is roughly a measure of relative brain size, has a different meaning in cetacean from its meaning in any other group of mammals. I made this slide during lunch, so it's not perfect. But I tried to find two pictures of the medial view of a human brain on the left and a dolphin, Triceps truncatus, brain on the right, and matched them up, trying to hit approximately the same cross-sectional area projection of the cerebellum, because dolphin cerebral hemispheres are shorter and taller and wider than those of human beings. So this is a rough attempt to put everything on not the same size scale, but a similar base length. And One of the things that I think will strike you about this comparison is the relatively small size in the dolphin.
This thing, the structure that I've colored here in yellow,
that's called the corpus callosum. It's not found in marsupials or in egg-laying mammals. It's peculiar to eutherian mammals. It is the big data bus, to use a computer analogy, which I hate doing, between the left and the right cerebral hemispheres. It's a big commissure, a band of transversely running axons that carry neurological signals from one hemisphere to the other. It's exceptionally and unexpectedly small in all the cetacea. And this goes along with other facts about their anatomy, their cranial anatomy. In particular, the two halves of the brain have essentially totally independent blood supplies. Okay, without the connections around the neck of the pituitary gland that are called the circle of Willis in human anatomy. Why should this be the case? I would like to suggest that it is probably the case because, and I'm not up to speed on this, so there may be more recent findings that disprove this, and if there are, I'd like to hear about them. But the last time I looked into this, there was evidence that if you anesthetize dolphins, they die. True? Okay, and the reason they die is they haven't got any breathing reflexes. Okay, the last thing that a dolphin wants to do if it becomes unconscious is to breathe, because it's going to breathe seawater. So when dolphins become unconscious, they stop breathing. And other dolphins then try to push them up to the surface and nudge them around and get them to revive so they can start breathing again. It follows that the dolphin cannot sleep. It can only sleep one cerebral hemisphere at a time. And there are electroencephalographic studies that have been done on captive dolphins that suggest that this is exactly what they do. They float at the surface and they turn off one cerebral hemisphere and it goes into slow wave sleep. And the other cerebral hemisphere stays awake and keeps the respiratory system operating. And then they switch sides. If so, then a dolphin is a natural split brain experiment. And one of the reasons that it has presumably such a large brain is that each half sometimes has to function as the only brain the animal's got. Okay, another problem with EQ in cetaceans, incidentally, is that a very large percentage of their body weight is metabolically inactive tissue, namely subcutaneous fat, blubber, okay, which doesn't have a very high turnover and is essentially sitting there as insulation, or in the case of the melanin in the head as an ultrasound lens for focusing echolocation signals. I would love to see a comparison of sea cows, which are another group of entirely aquatic animals that cannot come out on land to breathe, and yet which are almost completely missing cephalic. The sea cow brain looks like a potato. It has no sessile to speak of. Okay, finally, I'd like to just say a couple of things about Dan McShay's talk. I agree with Dan that David Hume was absolutely right at all times about everything. I have no problems with that. So we could all go home at that point. But I do have some questions about what Dan called, in one context, storytelling, and in another context, scenario building. I think those are two different things. I think what he's calling scenario building are simply if-then inferences. If I do this, then that will happen. And they're private. They're things that I think to myself, especially if I'm a cat. I don't tell other cats about them because I can't. And that means I can't really tell stories. I can't do the sort of thing that human beings do, and they drop into the sort of artistic production that our last presenters told us about, where we are working in a what-if, once-upon-a-time, dream-time cognitive mode, where everybody's been given a signal that this is a story, and so it doesn't count as truth functional. Okay? Other species don't have that. But I don't think that storytelling capacity is necessarily or inherently necessary to human-like kinds of mental abilities. And I think this because I think of the Houyhnhnms, the talking horses in Gulliver's Travels, which were perfectly logical beings of the sort sketched by Dan McShay at the beginning of his talk. They would not have been storytellers. They would dismiss stories as saying the thing which is not. as incomprehensible, and they would not be able to distinguish stories from lies. And in fact, that's just one of the reasons why Whitams are not very convincing. A lot of animals do, in fact, lie in a very simple, elementary fashion. They bluff in fights, and they have deceptive behaviors, sometimes directed towards predators. Okay, but deliberate lying, deceit that incorporates an understanding of what the other individual knows and can or cannot be expected to see through immediately, that is a talent of a very high order. It's a very advanced cognitive capacity demonstrated among mammals, mainly in certain anthropoid primates. But it's notable that the non-human animals that exhibit the most human-like language abilities, namely great apes and some birds, are among the most skillful liars in the animal kingdom. I don't know whether dolphins, which also have uncommon linguistic skills, are good liars, but I suspect that they would lie like a rug if they were given the chance in an appropriate...
They're very cheeky.
They're very cheeky. Okay, well, that's fair. That's close
enough.
They're liars. All right. Okay, so Jonathan Swift, to the contrary notwithstanding, I feel perfectly certain that if horses could talk, they would lie. And maybe not that kind of story. Thanks.